You're broken down and tired of living life on a merry-go-round. And you can't find a fighter, but I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to WOLB 1010 AM Talk Radio, featuring Team Radio Baltimore. This is Carol Mileta, your host of Parenting 411, where we share information parents need from sources they can trust. Welcome to part two of our series on overcoming trauma. You'll recall we explored this topic last time with Dr. Lori Hood, and we focused then on trauma and care for adults. And I wanted to start there because we know that in order to care for others, we have to follow the model recommended during aircraft emergencies, where you put on your oxygen mask first before tending to those around you. So when we think about children's needs in the midst of trauma or in the aftermath of trauma, it is critical that the adults in their lives are in good mental and emotional space to provide care for their children. So today, we're going to focus on children in the face of today's mass trauma, that is the pandemic, as well as other instances of trauma, abuse, and other harmful circumstances that children might be enduring. So here to talk with me about this is psychotherapist Beth Tyson. She is a trauma-informed care consultant, as well as the author of a therapeutic children's book. Welcome, Beth Tyson.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me today. Happy to be here.
Yes, I'm glad we were able to finally make it happen. It's been a while coming. So why don't we just kick off with you telling our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure, absolutely. So I am a mom to a 5-year-old little girl, and I'm also, as you said, a psychotherapist and a trauma-informed consultant. I work with organizations and families, helping them to become more trauma-aware, trauma-informed, and healing-centered. I also, like you said, wrote a children's book for grandfamilies, grandparents who are raising their grandchildren, to help bring awareness to this topic and to help children in that situation feel less alone.
Mm-hmm. And I really will get into that. Yeah, we definitely want to get into that a little later here. So describe your work and what it was like pre-pandemic and how it's changed since then.
Sure, it's changed a lot. So right before the pandemic, I published the book and I was going into a new role as a director of trauma therapy for a nonprofit organization called Grand Stepping Up. And we are an organization that offers free trauma therapy to grandparents raising their grandchildren. And with that pandemic hitting, everything shifted online. And so all the speaking events and the work that I was doing to spread awareness on these topics came to a halt, but they ended up picking back up online, which has really been a blessing because I've been able to reach people on a global scale now instead of just my local area. And I'm really spreading this message even further and wider than I ever expected to. So it's been, what would you say, a silver lining to a bad event. Yeah.
Right. And given that this trauma is so widespread, it really is a blessing that you are able to reach a lot more people than you previously could. Now, I wanted to ask you, are you still doing psychotherapy outside of what you're doing with Grand Stepping Up, or is that primarily where you're devoting your time now?
So I'm primarily devoting my time to doing consulting and coaching for families and organizations who are really struggling to understand trauma and how it impacts children's lives. So I've moved away from the psychotherapy piece at this time, but it's definitely something I'll go back to in the future.
And so when you're working with children and families who are dealing with trauma and loss, what's your approach? Do you work with the parents and children in one session, or, you know, do you focus primarily on the children and some, you know, how do you do it?
Yeah, sure. So what I do is I work from an attachment theory perspective. I really work on rebuilding and reestablishing trust and safety within the families, and helping parents to understand and recognize the impact that trauma has on the brain and the neurobiological impacts on the body as well as the mind. So it's more of a holistic approach, looking at all the things that impact a child who has been through a lot of adversity. And so I've developed a model called the CARES model of building trust. And it has five components, which is gaining consent before trying to soothe or approach a child who may be upset. And this is for teachers, professionals, social workers, and caregivers. So gaining consent from a child who has experienced trauma is a really important first step, because oftentimes their boundaries have been violated by adults. And so we really need to be certain that the child wants, you know, a physical touch or wants to be approached for soothing or comfort when they are feeling dysregulated and upset. So that's the first step. And then I teach about accepting the emotions instead of invalidating emotions. So often we are taught and we learn from, you know, how we were raised, that we just tell a child, it's okay, don't cry, don't worry, everything's fine, you're going to be okay. But the message that sends is invalidating to a child's emotions. So what we want to do is, instead of deflecting from what the child has experienced, is accepting what the child is experiencing. And that can be painful for adults, but it's a necessary step to say, I can see you're in pain right now, and I'm here with you. Mm-hmm. And that's going to help the child move out of their dysregulation when they feel heard and understood, instead of invalidated. So acceptance is the next step. Then we go to reflecting what we see in a child's emotions. So reflecting to the child anything they might be feeling. So you seem to be really angry right now, instead of, again, invalidating the emotion, you're accepting and then reflecting what you're seeing. This helps build emotional awareness within the child's concept of emotion. And then intervening with, you know, something that might help them to feel a little bit better. So you can think of something that helps you, or maybe it's a coping skill such as blowing up all your bad feelings into a bag and then let it, like a paper bag, blow up your feelings in there and then let them out the window and, you know, release the air out the window or into a balloon, something like that that you can do. I have lots of tips and tricks for those that are struggling with big emotions. So the next step after that is educating. So educating the child about emotions and their feelings. Once they seem to have calmed down, you don't want to just start educating and lecturing a child who's dysregulated. That doesn't work. Their brain, the prefrontal cortex of their brain, is literally offline once they reach a certain level of arousal. I heard Lori Hood talk about the window of tolerance last week, and that certainly is a crucial concept to understand when we look at trauma, is that if a child is outside of that window of tolerance, anything you are saying to them is not computing. It's not coming together, and they're really not hearing you. They're unable to hear you. So trying to lecture or teach a lesson in a moment of chaos or complete upset and overwhelm in a child, you're really not making any progress. It's best to wait until they've calmed down and regulated with you, which is called co-regulation, and find a moment later on to talk about the lesson that might be learned from all this. But you can educate once that process has settled down, and then the last step is sharing your vulnerability with a child. So sharing a time when you felt really upset, sharing a time when you failed, sharing a time when you felt intense grief or loss, really helps the child understand that they're not alone in their experiences, and there's someone out there who has come through it before them, and so can they. It's empowering.
Yes, and this model is really something that I think that parents and caregivers can really relate to and put into practice. I mean, the way you just laid it out, the way you explained it, I think it's really something that they could really pick up on really easily and put it into practice when helping their children with trauma. And, you know, there was a couple of things that you talked about as well that I think it is important for people to understand is the impact that trauma has on the physical state of the brain. Like it can change. It can change that. And then also where you talked about what's going on in a child's mind as they are processing and responding to trauma, I think that understanding is really important for the adults in their lives as well, so that, you know, we won't be so quick to say, oh, you know, you're just being emotional. You're just, you know, you're not, you know, it's not that big a deal. Get over it. But there's really something powerful and major going on inside, within the child, within their brain, which is the command center. So I really appreciate how you explained that to us. And so what are some outward signs that caregivers can look for when determining how trauma is affecting a child or if a child has been traumatized?
Sure. There's lots of symptoms. And, you know, I like to say that behavior is always a symptom, not the problem. So that means that what you're seeing visually or witnessing or observing is not necessarily that the child is choosing to behave this way consciously. Oftentimes there are triggers in the environment that we are unaware of, that the child is unaware of. Could be the smell of mom's perfume. If mom is no longer in the child's life, that can be a trigger. It could be a song they hear on the radio. It could be the smell of firewood burning. I mean, it could be any sensory experience that tips a child off to a potential threat. And those are called triggers. And if we can try and evaluate and predict when a trigger might happen, then we can manage the outcome with the child a little bit better. We can prepare ahead of time, and we can build in support around those potential triggers, because sometimes they're unavoidable. But they're also, sometimes we don't even know what they are. But if a child is triggered and their trauma has been triggered, you typically see four different responses. These are the trauma responses. You'll see a child who is in fight, flight, freeze, or a lesser known reaction called fawning. And fight looks like that explosive child, the child who is overwhelmed and unable to manage their behavior. You'll see tantrums. You'll see aggression, possibly violence, fighting with others, stirring up conflict. And this is something that happens repeatedly and frequently and intensely over time. So it's not just your average aggression. It looks bigger than that. And then you'll also see in the flight would be the withdrawn behavior. So a child who shuts down, who lacks affection, is uninterested in social interaction with others, doesn't just kind of gets lost in their video games or their tablets and really shuts himself off that way, socially and emotionally from others. Then we have flight.
Freeze, right?
Then we have freeze. And freeze is a tough one. It's really, I feel like it's the deepest form of a trauma response, where child literally just shuts down completely, may dissociate, maybe in a flashback, and really needs grounding to bring them into the present moment. And I teach about grounding activities for children with an acronym called RATS. I like acronyms. So there's steps you can take to help a child ground themselves if they're feeling dissociated or in a flashback of some kind. And then we have fawning, which is a lesser known reaction, but we see fawning when a child is overly compliant and exceptionally obedient to adults in an attempt to protect themselves. So it's befriending your enemy in a way, so that you are less exposed to potential harm. And these look like children who are just not rocking the boat. they get great grades, even though, despite their trauma, they usually do very well in school. They don't get into trouble. They follow all the rules. They do what you tell them to, and everybody thinks they're fine, and they don't need therapy, and they don't need support. And unfortunately, it's absolutely not true. A lot of times this trauma will be latent, which means it'll show up later on in life, or they're suffering in silence out of fear of sharing their true feelings with anybody. So these children are also suffering very deeply, even if they don't look or appear to be suffering on the surface. So we really need to shift from providing trauma therapy or any type of therapy only when we see behaviors. We need to provide therapy and support to children if we know they have a history of trauma, regardless of their behaviors. I feel strongly about that.
Mm-hmm. Those were very helpful. I mean, those modes of, it's almost like a way that they're coping. I mean, it's not in a healthy way, but, you know, that's really interesting. And I wonder if we could circle back to hear a little bit more about what you were saying about how to help children get grounded when they're in that freeze mode.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So grounding techniques are, they're used for those with PTSD or complex PTSD, which a lot of children also are struggling with. And what they are is mindfulness tools to bring a person back into the present moment. You know, when we get grounded in the present moment, we realize that there really is no other time but right now. You know, the past is gone and the future is not yet here. And so in the presence, we have safety. You know, we can feel safe knowing that right now we are okay. And so what we do is we try to bring people who maybe psychologically have left the room, you know, in quotations, bring them back into the room. And we do that by somatic bodily work. So it's feeling, it's asking the person to sit in a chair and feel their feet on the floor, grounded to the floor. It's asking them to repeat any sound they can hear in the environment. It's really engaging in your senses, your five senses. So you ask them five things you can see, five things you can hear right now, five things you can touch, you know, and all of this brings you back into the moment and into the present. And then from there, once you're back in that present moment, you can begin to work through the emotions.
Wow, that's really powerful. Now, I want to think about how, you know, sometimes children can be so forgiving and appear amazingly resilient, you know, just like, you know, the way you describe some of these modes of behavior that they might take on. And, you know, sometimes the adults around them will just assume that they should just be able to push through without any professional help. And so I'm wondering, what are some examples of trauma that people, that children come to you with? Because, I wonder, it might be kind of surprising some of those things where, adults may think it's not a big deal, but actually it's something that ought to really be addressed. And like you've seen this, you know, in your work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So resilience is a word that I love and I also don't like at the same time because of its misinterpretation. So resilience is something that develops, and this is according to trauma expert Dr. Bruce Perry, who is a renowned scientist and doctor in this area. But resilience develops from moderate, predictable, and controllable circumstances in a child's life. Anything outside of that can be overwhelming to a child. An example of something that is an event or an experience that's moderate, predictable, and controllable would be like a child playing a sport. You know, there's some element of fear around it, but it's not overwhelming. There's some worries of not doing well enough, but they're able to manage it. They know when the practice is scheduled, so it's predictable, or the game is scheduled, that's predictable. They know that the stress they're going to feel is typically a moderate amount of stress, and then controllable. They can refuse to go if they want to. You know, that's always an option. Nobody can make you go and play a sport, right? So there's some control there. But when experiences get outside of those descriptions is when we start to see resilience break down. And it's not as helpful for children to be resilient. And oftentimes what we think of as resilience is really that fawning reaction, that that silence or that even that that freeze reaction or that flight reaction where they're really just withdrawing, they're really suppressing the emotions. They're really just doing what people expect them to do because it's too overwhelming to face. And so so that's really important to be able to delineate between, you know, are we really creating resilience as a word that relieves adults of their guilt for the challenges and the experiences that we're actually putting children into. So it becomes something adults like to say, oh, kids are resilient. They'll get over it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does that do? That invalidates a child's experience, which we know it causes harm. And it also relieves adults of their guilt for whatever is going on in the picture. And the truth is that just like adults, children also feel all the emotions and all the pain and the trauma. So there really is no difference between adult resilience and children's resilience. They're not born resilient. Well, maybe to a degree, people have different temperaments. You know, some people can handle more than others in life, but really resilience is developed over time by those moderate, predictable, and controllable environments and through secure relationships with healthy adults. You know, attachment and having a secure relationship with a primary caregiver is a strong foundation for resiliency. And that means the ability to bounce back after a stressor or life's hardships. That's, you know, sort of my definition of resiliency. And that is formed through relationships with secure attachment to a primary caregiver. And a lot of our kids who are facing trauma do not have that. And they have either lost those primary caregivers or the ones that are in their place are incapable of caring for them appropriately. And so they don't have that foundation for resilience.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just sitting here just thinking about all that you're saying, because we do throw around, you know, the word resiliency, and, you know, and sometimes, you know, at least what I'm getting from you, and I, you know, I just hadn't thought about it quite this way before, is that, being resilient to in dysfunctional situations, that's harmful. And,
right.
You know, yeah, it's harmful. And then also you're also explaining why children that have faced multiple traumas in their life and don't have the stability, you know, that helps to build resilience over time. It, you know, you kind of understand why they're struggling, you know, with whatever is going, you know, the extreme trauma in their lives and why they can't buck up and be resilient the way, you know, some adults would like them to, so that they can move along and not deal with the situation. So, you know, that's interesting. We got to be kind of careful about how we throw that around, you know, that word around, and, you know, particularly
yeah.
with our children. Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad that you do. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no. That's okay. No, I you know, again, I appreciate that. And I wanted to now shift to how children are, you know, faring in the midst of this coronavirus, the pandemic, and how the, you know, the new restrictions are affecting their lives. What are you seeing there?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, we are seeing record levels of anxiety and depression right now in children and adults. We're all struggling. And it's that collective struggling that we're all facing right now. And, you know, I feel like we've put mental health on the back burner for so long. And it's been, you know, stigmatized, and it just hasn't been on the forefront of our culture. And now I think we're finally waking up. to the idea that we really need to support our mental health. And so for me, that's a good thing, I think. I think that's a wonderful shift that we're seeing from all this. Again, another silver lining. But at the same time, children and families are really facing the brunt of the impact of this pandemic, and parents with children under 18 especially, because the school-age children are, you know, facing so much adversity with this back and forth of online, offline schooling and the fears of catching the virus. And then, of course, there's grief and loss if somebody has lost a family member or caregiver to the virus. And so there's a lot of heightened anxiety and struggles around parenting and sort of teaching children from home. It's really become a stressor for the American family and families all around the world. So, yeah, we're seeing higher rates of anxiety and depression, and we're also seeing the research is still not conclusive, but there is evidence pointing to a risk in suicidal events in children as well. So, again, that evidence is not finalized yet, but there seems to be some supporting evidence in that direction. So we really do need to shore up our children's mental health and our own mental health and really take this seriously. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we have been, you know. I think as a general population, we really haven't been focused on mental health for children. And really it's the foundation of learning, in my opinion, and maybe some others, is that you can't learn and do these higher functioning things in life without first having your mental health in a good place. So your brain just doesn't work that way.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
So I'm wondering, are you thinking that we're not paying enough attention to children's mental health? Do you think that was the case before the pandemic, or are you saying in the midst of this, we're not?
I'm saying before, definitely before the pandemic, we are not making children's mental health a priority. We are starting to see in schools this, you know, the social emotional learning piece, but we're still not helping children cope with adversity. And we're not helping children understand their brains. You know, we're teaching them about all the other subjects in school, but they really are taught very little about how their brains work and how their emotions work and, you know, how relationships work and what healthy relationships are and, you know, all these things that lead to mental health, right? And and so I think there needs to be a focus on that. And then, of course, there's the focus on adverse childhood events, but there's also a flip side to that. There's positive childhood experiences that lead to a greater sense of resiliency and hope and future success. And so, you know, I think we need to focus on those positive childhood experiences and incorporate more of that into our children's lives so that we can, you know, fortify them with the tools and skills that they need to cope with life's difficulties. I just don't think we're preparing our children well enough. It's like, you know, sending them to walk off a cliff without a net right now. I mean, it's just, there's just so much going on in our world, and there's really no safety net to catch them because nobody's there offering guidance and education on this piece. So I'm just an advocate for that, obviously, and really trying to spread this message as far as wide as I can and share these skills so that people have access to them. Yeah.
I agree with you. I think it should be part of their school day or their school week somehow to bring that into the curriculum. I think that they would be so much better, you know, adjusted and just equipped to meet life's challenges, you know?
Right.
I agree with you there. Now, are you seeing any anxiety or concern about the protests for justice, racial equality, and just the climate, you know, following the election and all of that? Are you seeing any anxiety about that among children?
Yes, of course. They are sponges, as we like to say, and they are really absorbing all of this information. And it's taxing. It really is. And it may not be obvious, but and a lot of times I think, and I make this mistake too, as an adult, to just because I'm in this field doesn't mean I do it all perfectly or I have all the answers. I also make these mistakes with my daughter in terms of like letting her hear just too much of us talking about the pandemic or the racial inequality or the political climate. You know, they overhear these things and that gets into their minds and it makes, they worry. They really do worry. Children may not show it outwardly, but they really do worry about these things and they sense it. They can mirror our emotions. So if we've been on high alert and feeling very anxious and keyed up, our child actually feels that too. They have mirror neurons in their brain that mirror the neurons in our brain. And so that's why we really have to focus on adult, like you said in the beginning of the show, about your own self-care and your own well-being, because it really is that the water flows downhill, you know, or whatever that saying is. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you really, you know, what you're feeling flows into your child. And so we really have to take care of ourselves as well. But yeah, definitely everybody is experiencing a heightened reaction to what's been going on. And it's a stressor we haven't seen in a long time. And for children under 18, this is their first political trauma or their first social trauma because they weren't alive during 9/11. And so, and even for myself, like this is my second major circumstance and I'm anxious, you know, and I'm a therapist and I know the coping skills and what to do. And I'll tell you, I wake up sometimes in the middle of the night and I'm scared. You know, and it's just, you know, and then I do my things to help me feel better and, you know, and I move along. But for people that don't have those skills, I can only imagine what it feels like for them. And I can imagine because I've been there. I've struggled with my own anxiety and depression throughout my life. So I think that, you know, in the long run, I think, you know, here's what I like to say is that, you know, injustice leads to anger and anger leads to action and action leads to change. And so, although I know we're in the middle of all this right now and nothing looks possible for a bright outcome, is that no positive or very little positive change happens without upheaval and without loss of life. And, you know, we wouldn't be where we are today without, you know, the terrible circumstances that went on earlier in our history, and the loss of life that happened there. And so that's how I keep myself, grounded in hope that, you know, eventually some good will come out of this, although it may take time.
Yeah. I can relate to that as well. I mean, I was thinking about that as well, just really in thinking about the last 4 years and all of that and how, you know, things might have been different. We might, a lot of what we're dealing with now would not have come up, you know, to the open. I mean, you know, how long had we been talking about, you know, the resurgence of racial injustice and certainly, you know, and with the law enforcement community and the Black community and Black and brown communities. And, you know, but like recent events, painful events, kind of raised awareness of those things. And, you know, that's something that I had been thinking about over the last few years as well. So I want to talk about your work with kinship families and grandparents as they step in to raise children who have experienced abuse and other traumas. Let's just talk about that. How widespread is this phenomenon, and what is it that you and the organization you serve, what are you doing to support families like this?
Yes, absolutely. So there are about 3 million documented grand families, I like to call them. Grand families are any household where the grandparent is the primary provider and caregiver for the children in the home. And we have about, like I said, 3 million in the U.S., and this is a worldwide phenomenon that, you know, is happening in every country around the globe. That's the number we have documented, but there are many more who are raising their grandchildren through informal circumstances that we're just not aware of. So we know this number is bigger. But according to the information we have about 2.8 million right now. And this is due mostly to the growing opioid epidemic, substance abuse, untreated mental health problems, incarceration, poverty, and other unfortunate circumstances. So this is a big number of the population, and even that's a number of that's a number of families. But if you break that down into the number of children, again, that number is much higher because, you know, some families have multiple children. So so I worked as a child welfare crisis or trauma therapist, and I worked with foster, kinship, and adoptive families. And in that work, I had close relationships with a lot of grandparents who were raising their grandchildren. And I always wanted to bring a children's book to help them understand their circumstances. Oftentimes, children in foster care, they don't know why they are not living with mom and dad, and they don't understand why their life has suddenly changed. And so I always wanted a tool or resource to help them understand it in a way that was kid-friendly and supportive and something they could understand. But when I went to look for a children's book on the topic, I just couldn't find one. And there were 9 other therapists on my team, and none of them had a resource like this. And so we would joke in our team meetings like, oh, who's going to write this book? You know, one day, one of us is going to write this book. We need this book. So that was, you know, 5 years ago or so. And then about a year and a half ago, maybe it was 2 years ago. Yeah, I guess it was 2 years ago now, I decided to write this story about a child who's being raised by his grandmother. And I really wanted people to understand the reactions that they're seeing from the children, because a lot of times the grandparents are struggling with these big behaviors and these big emotions, and they take it. It can be hard not to take that personally when you are on the receiving end of it. And I get that. I do. I sometimes take things personally with my own daughter. So I know how that feels. But in this case, when these children have experienced so much loss and unprocessed grief and trauma, they really aren't, their behavior really isn't personal. It's a reaction. It's a coping skill for safety. And it's also a lot of times that there's so many worries going on underneath the surface that adults are not even aware of. So if a child is removed from their parents and put into the care of a family member, they're probably constantly worried about where mom and dad are. Are they safe? Are they okay? Are they healthy? When am I going to see them again? Am I going to see them again? What's going to happen to me? How long am I going to live here before I have to leave? You know, when you have all these thoughts on your mind, it becomes almost impossible to respond rationally to life circumstances. And so you feel a lot of anger and explosion and the other symptoms I talked about earlier today. But then the child gets labeled or viewed as, you know, the bad kid or troublesome or acting out, misbehaving, and all these things. And it's like, no, they really need answers. They really need to understand what's the truth of their life. And so I wrote the book to help share the truth of their life in an age-appropriate, kid-friendly way, and to help adults understand the emotions that are going on underneath the surface and to not take things so personally. And then I built in coping skills within the story as well. So that was kind of the work I was doing there. And then also working with Grand Stepping Up to provide like holistic care for grandparents raising their grandchildren, including reduced cost legal services. We have free trauma therapy program, and we have a food and baby pantry, as well as social support, you know, having support group meetings and a place for grandparents and grandchildren to not feel so alone and disconnected from the average American family because they look different, you know, which a lot of kids are bullied because it's like, oh, why are your parents so old? Or, you know, where's your mom? You know, and then these kids, they get teased and bullied. And so they really need to be around other kids in their same circumstance so they can see that they're not alone. And that's another reason why I wrote the book was to, when you see yourself in a book or in a story, you can, it can be incredibly healing to know that you're not the only one, because a lot of times you're isolated in this experience. You might not know anybody else in your shoes, but when you see it in a book, it's like, wow, you know, this isn't just happening to me. And I just wanted children to feel a little less alone in this experience. And so that's the work we're doing. I'm just trying to spread these messages as far and wide as I can using social media. And I have a Facebook group and other things and a website, a blog that I write. And so, yeah, so that's kind of where we are at this point.
Oh, and it sounds like that's a tremendous resource in the community. And, you know, as you were talking, I was kind of even thinking, I mean, not only are the grandparents dealing with, you know, the child's emotions and the way they are coping with the trauma and the behavior that results from that, but I guess in a way the grandparents are also processing the trauma that led to this, like whatever, you know, with whatever event that happened, to cause their child, the grandchild to come to live with them. So there's that too, that they're dealing with. So it's really heroic. You know, these grandparents are stepping up given all that they're dealing with. So, so it's wonderful that you have, you know, have these resources for them to really support them in that. So, and I hope that more organizations, whether nonprofit or even, you know, state and local government agencies, really start to invest in this, because, you know, as you said, it is pretty widespread and probably much larger than the numbers you quoted of 2.8 million. Because some families, this is just a way that they solve problems for many years. You know,
exactly.
Just taking in the children. So I appreciate that. So I know you are so passionate about the work that you do, and that's wonderful. So I was wondering if you could share with us an example of you know, a favorable outcome that you were able to bring about for a child and how it made you feel.
Yeah, sure. I have many to choose from, but one that stands out to me is about a grand family. And I have another one about an adopted girl. But, you know, I had this client one time that was a grandson being raised by his grandparents, and he had just become, you know, the troubled kid, you know, that just wouldn't participate, wouldn't cooperate, wouldn't engage with anybody. And he wouldn't even meet with me. He had been so burnt out of people coming and going that he didn't trust me. And I was another person coming into the picture that was probably just going to disappoint him and let him down. So I really decided to show up every week anyway, even though he would refuse to meet with me. And I met with his grandmother, and I really got to know her and the struggles that she was facing, and worked with her through a parenting curriculum that we had developed that was based in attachment theory and based in, you know, creating safety and trust within the relationship and really understanding trauma. And she really was able to shift her perspective from seeing her grandson as troubled to seeing her grandchild as somebody who is suffering and really struggling and just doing his best. Because as I believe, children do the best they can when they can. And that's a quote from, I believe it is Dr. Green. And my other quote is that a child who can show you his rage does not think you are an easy target. He thinks you are someone who won't abandon him. And I really had to help shift the perspective of the adults in his life, the caregivers in his life, to see that he was doing the best he could, and that he really, you know, was not able to to function in a family the way you would expect him to based off of the experiences he had. The other problem was that once I got grandma on board, grandfather didn't want to participate in therapy. But with some support and some encouragement, we were able to get him at the table to participate. And once we did that, we really started to see a huge shift. Because once you have both caregivers involved and being consistent in the type of trust building activities that I was suggesting, you really can make a shift. So I think it's important. You know, therapy tends to become the responsibility of the female, even in today's world. And we really need to get fathers and grandfathers into the conversation so that once they can understand that perspective, you really start to see change. And so this child, you know, made progress leaps and bounds, and it was really just heartwarming to see the bond grow between them and the behavior starting to change. And there's somebody I think about all the time and wonder how they're doing even to this day. So that was, it's really fulfilling and good to see that it really is about how we see people that makes a big difference in how we react to them.
Mm-hmm. Right. I agree. I realized too that we did not, I don't think we did, tell everyone the title of your book and where they could get it.
Oh, well, look at that. Good catch. Thank you. So the name of my book is called A Grand Family for Sullivan, and it's an adorable koala and his grandmother, and they're just the cutest thing. My illustrator really knocked it out of the park. Can't take credit for the illustrations, but everybody really, really enjoys them. And, yes, so it's called A Grand Family for Sullivan, and it's available on Amazon. So you can just search either my name, which is Beth Tyson, or A Grand Family for Sullivan. It has 64 five-star reviews, and I just get messages all the time from people who have found the book helpful, even not only for grandparents raising their grandchildren, but for any child who's going through a major transition or a big change in their life, have found it really helpful. So, and you can also find links to everything on my website, BethTyson.com, where I share a blog about trauma-informed parenting and mental health resources for emotional well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Beth Tyson.
Mm-hmm. Okay, BethTyson.com. I also was thinking that, you know, your book, you know, is also useful for other children that just, maybe they're not experiencing trauma, but it really kind of exposes them to other situations. As you said, that families look different. And, you know, some people live with their grandparents, some people live with their parents. But it also can just maybe be a way of teaching some empathy toward, you know, other students and all of that. And just, you know, I think that should inform their reading experience as well. I know I really try to find a variety of books for my sons when they were growing up with, you know, dealing with different situations that sometimes were not like ours, but so that it could just expose them and let them know that, you know, takes a lot of people to make the world go round, and people have different situations. And I really think that familiarity or that exposure can kind of reduce the fear that comes when you see people that believe different things or live a different way. It doesn't threaten you. It's new information for you, but it doesn't have to negate you. It doesn't harm you. It's not something you have to strike out and, strike down. Differences. It's just, you know, it's just new information for you to inform how the world is made up.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a really good point. Yeah, I definitely think it could be a tool for building that empathy. We really need it. We really need empathy for these families because they're going through it. They're really facing a lot of hardships and pain. And the last thing they need is other kids in school giving them a hard time about it or not understanding, you know, and even, you know, I like to speak out on these family tree activities that are so harmful and re-traumatizing to children who don't come from traditional family dynamics. And so any spreading of awareness that we can do around, you know, that families, they look different. They all are different, really. And no two are alike in a lot of ways. So, yeah, I agree with that. Thank you for sharing that point. It's really important.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we wind down to our last few minutes, I did want to ask you that what you could offer as some strategies that listeners could practice in helping their children cope, aside from seeking professional help. You know, just how they can cope with what's going on with the pandemic. Just some helpful tips to kind of help children move through this, get through the day, you know, just kind of to get through the day even sometimes, if you have any ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, anytime anxiety is high, your brain is telling your body that it needs to do something. It needs to move. It needs to find a way to dissipate those stress hormones. And so really getting some extra movement into your life is important, whether it be a walk outside, nature, being in nature and outdoors is really healing for myself and for others. But if that's not possible, you know, having outlets for a child's nervous energy can be really helpful. So maybe it's a trampoline, an indoor trampoline they bounce on, or maybe it's Velcro strips that you put underneath their school desk so that they can sort of do the Velcro over and over again while they're online learning to help dissipate some of their extra energy. Maybe it's, you know, going for a family walk together, incorporating some family traditions that are new, you know, that you might not have had, where it's an opportunity to talk. One thing that's really important and helpful to know is that children typically will open up more about their feelings in the evening before bed. So if you have a child who's more withdrawn and isn't really sharing much, I encourage you to find an activity you can do side by side together so that you're not directly looking at each other, which can often be intimidating. And do something where you're busy with something, but not so busy that you can't have a meaningful conversation. Maybe it's you're both doing a puzzle next to each other or coloring next to each other. And then that's a good time of the evening before bed to check in with the emotional stuff. Because the children just, for some reason, their brains just tend to be more open to sharing at that time of day. And so, you know, it's good to strike up a conversation and check in with your child. How, you know, first pointing out the obvious, you know, things have been really hard lately, you know, and I've noticed that you're having a hard time with X, Y, or Z, you know, whatever it might be. You know, what's going on for you? What's that like for you? And just waiting, you know, for an answer and just, and going through that cares model of accepting the emotions and reflecting the emotions and educating them that big feelings are normal and that we all have these feelings from time to time, and so taking them through that. And then some other little quick things you can do. There's a website called GoNoodle.com, and they have an awesome activity. It's called the freeze and melt activity, where you practice dissipating some of your anxiety and fears by tensing your body up really tight. And then like an ice cube, you know, frozen and then melting like, you know, warm water. And so then you melt and you let go of all your muscles. And it's kind of a progressive muscle relaxation type of activity that can calm the central nervous system down if they're feeling really wound up. Counterintuitively, cold showers can actually snap people out of anxiety. So I always recommend that to people who are experiencing a lot of panic or anxious feelings. Try taking a cold shower. Also, a cold compress on the back of the neck can be helpful for children, as long as you have their consent. I always like to have that caveat. But and then one I started mentioning earlier, which I didn't explain fully, was blowing all of our bad emotions into like a paper bag, you know, and like, or any type of container, that you can put the lid on or something, some type of container. It doesn't have to be a bag, but, you know, blowing all your feelings into that box or container and then opening up a door or window and letting them all go. It can just be a nice visual experience, visualization type of experience, and also practice turning down the volume on this, any scary or difficult thoughts, you know, instead of listening to them really loud, say, you know, asking them, do you think we can try and turn down the volume on some of those thoughts right now and be quiet and be still with what we're feeling? And so there's all types of different suggestions that I have out there, but I think that might be helpful.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that. I'm going to share some of these, when I post the replay of the show. Thank you for that. Now, do you have anything coming up? Sure, thank you. Do you have anything coming up that you would like to share with our listeners?
Sure. I have a Facebook Live coming up on March 4th, and it will be on trust-based caregiving. So really working on building that trust with the children in your life. And it can be for caregivers. It can be for professionals that work with children, social workers, teachers, educators, you know, anybody that touches a child's life. And we'll just see, we'll be talking about some of these topics in more detail. And you can find that on my Facebook page, which is Beth Tyson Trauma Care.
Okay.
And there's also a Facebook group for mental health professionals and caregivers and teachers called Emotiminds. And that's Emotiminds. And it is for increasing emotional well-being within children and families.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for that. And here's a little bit at that's coming up at the Parenting 411. We have the I Am a Victor Summit on Friday, February 19th at 9 a.m. I will be speaking there, and you will be able to hear throughout the day very powerful stories. That's what everyone will be sharing, powerful stories where they have overcome obstacles. Next up for me, I'll be speaking at the Black CEO Iconic Digital Summit. There I'll be talking about how mompreneurs can show up for their children even as they're trying to build their businesses. On a similar topic, I will be speaking at the Unstoppable Women Summit on February 27th at 11 a.m. And on this topic again, I'll be speaking at the See Life Different Virtual Summit on March 2nd through the 4th. You can register there at carolmaletta.com/life21. And as always, you can learn more about what I'm doing at carolmaletta.com and follow me at the Parenting 411 on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I want to thank all of you for listening again. And thank you, Beth, for coming. I am sure I'm going to need to bring you back. You are a wealth of information that I know that parents can certainly use in, you know, helping their children to, you know, process challenges in their lives. So stay tuned for that.
Fantastic. I'd love to come back. Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be here today.
All right. Thank you very much. And we will be talking to you next time.